and of willows. Then came the summer, and the time of moths, and the warm evenings. And Tuor wondered at the multitude of flies, at their buzzing and the droning of the beetles and the hum of bees. And to all these things he gave names of his own, and wove the names into new songs on his old harp. And these songs were softer than his singing of old. Then Ulmo grew in dread lest Tuor dwell forever here, and the great things of his design come not to fulfilment. Therefore he feared longer to trust Tuor's guidance to the Noldali alone, who did service to him in secret, and out of fear of Melko wavered much. Nor were they strong against the magic of that place of willows, for very great was its enchantment. Behold, now Ulmo leapt upon his car before the doorway of his palace below the still waters of the outer sea, and his car was drawn by narwhal and sea lion, and was in fashion like a whale, and amidst the sounding of great conches he sped from Ulmonan. So great was the speed of his going that in days, and not in years without count as might be thought, he reached the mouth of the river. Up this his car might not fare without hurt to its water and its banks. Therefore Ulmo, loving all rivers, and this one more than most, went thence on foot, robed to the middle in mail like the scales of blue and silver fishes. But his hair was a bluish silver, and his beard to his feet was of the same hue, and he bore neither helm nor crown. Beneath his mail fell the skirts of his kirtle of shimmering greens, and of what substance these were woven is not known. But whoso looked into the depths of their subtle colours seemed to behold the faint movements of deep waters shot with the stealthy lights of phosphorescent fish that live in the abyss. Girt was he with a rope of mighty pearls, and he was shod with mighty shoes of stone. Thither he bore too his great instrument of music, and this was of strange design, for it was made of many long twisted shells pierced with holes. Blowing therein, and playing with his long fingers, he made deep melodies of a magic greater than any other among musicians hath ever compassed on harp or lute, on lyre or pipe, or instruments of the bow. Then, coming along the river, he sat among the reeds at twilight and played upon his thing of shells, and it was nigh to those places where Tuor tarried. And Tuor hearkened, and was stricken dumb. There he stood, knee-deep in the grass, and heard no more the hum of insects, nor the murmur of the river borders, and the odour of flowers entered not into his nostrils, but he heard the sound of waves and the wail of sea-birds, and his soul leapt for rocky places and the ledges that reek of fish, for the splash of the diving cormorant, and those places where the sea bores into the black cliffs and yells aloud. Then Ulmo arose and spoke to him, and for dread he came near to death, for the depth of the voice of Ulmo is of the uttermost depth, even as deep as his eyes, which are the deepest of all things. And Ulmo said, O Tuor of the lonely heart, I will not that thou dwell forever in fair places of birds and flowers, nor would I lead thee through this pleasant land, but that so it must be. But fare now on thy destined journey, and tarry not, for far from hence is thy weird set. Now must thou seek through the lands for the city of the folk called Gondothlim, or the dwellers in stone, and the Noldali shall escort thee thither in secret, for fear of the spies of Melko. Words I will set to your mouth there, and there you shall abide a while. Yet may be thy life shall turn again to the mighty waters, and of a surety a child shall come of thee, than whom no man shall know more of the uttermost deeps, be it of the sea or of the firmament of heaven. Then spoke Ulmo also to Tuor some of his design and desire, but thereof Tuor understood little at that time, and feared greatly. Then Ulmo was wrapped in a mist, as it were, of sea air in those inland places, and Tuor, with that music in his ears, would fain return to the regions of the great sea. Yet remembering his bidding, turned and went inland along the river, and so fared till day. Yet he that has heard the conches of Ulmo hears them call him till death, and so did Tuor find. When day came he was weary and slept till it was nigh dusk again, and the Noldali came to him and guided him. So fared he many days by dusk and dark, and slept by day, and because of this it came afterwards that he remembered not over well the paths that he traversed in those times. Now Tuor and his guides held on untiring, and the land became one of rolling hills, and the river wound about their feet, and there were many dales of exceeding pleasantness. But here the Noldali became ill at ease. "These," said they, "are the confines of those regions which Melko infesteth with his goblins, the people of hate. Far to the north, yet alas, not far enough, would they were 10,000 leagues, lie the mountains of iron, where sits the power and terror of Melko, whose thralls we are. Indeed, in this guiding of thee, we do in secret from him, and did he know all our purposes, the torment of the Balrogs would be ours." Falling then into such fear, the Noldali soon after left him, and he fared alone amid the hills. And their going proved ill afterwards, for Melko has many eyes, it is said, and while Tuor fared with the gnomes, they took him twilight ways and by many secret tunnels through the hills. But now he became lost, and climbed often to the tops of knolls and hills, scanning the lands about. Yet he might not see signs of any dwelling of folk. And indeed the city of the Gondothlim was not found with ease, seeing that Melko and his spies had not even yet discovered it. It is said nonetheless that at this time those spies got wind thus that the strange foot of man had been set in those lands, and that for that Melko doubled his craft and watchfulness. Now when the gnomes out of fear deserted Tuor, one Voronwe or Bronweg followed afar off despite his fear, when chiding availed not to enhearten the others. Now Tuor had fallen into a great weariness, and was sitting beside the rushing stream, and the sea-longing was about his heart, and he was minded once more to follow this river back to the wide waters and the roaring waves. But this Voronwe the faithful came up with him again, and standing by his ear said, "O Tuor, think not that but thou shalt again one day see thy desire. Arise now, and behold, I will not leave thee. I am not of the road learned of the Noldali, being a craftsman and maker of things made by a hand of wood and of metal, and I joined not the band of escort till late. Yet of old have I heard whispers and sayings said in secret amid the weariness of thraldom, concerning a city where Noldali might be free, could they find the hidden way thereto. And we twain may without a doubt find a road to the city of stone, where is that freedom of the Gondothlim." Know then that the Gondothlim were that kin of the Noldali who alone escaped Melko's power, when at the Battle of Unnumbered Tears he slew and enslaved their folk, and wove spells about them, and caused them to dwell in the hells of iron, faring thence at his will and bidding only. Long time did Tuor and Voronwe seek for the city of that folk, until after many days they came upon a deep dale amid the hills. Here went the river over a very stony bed with much rush and noise, and it was curtained with a heavy growth of alders, but the walls of the dale were sheer, for they were nigh to some mountains which Voronwe knew not. There in the green wall that gnome found an opening like a great door with sloping sides, and this was cloaked with thick bushes and long tangled undergrowth, yet Voronwe's piercing sight might not be deceived. Nonetheless it is said that such a magic had its builders set about it, by aid of Ulmo whose power ran in that river, even if the dread of Melko fared upon its banks, that none save of the blood of the Noldali might light on it thus by chance. Nor would Tuor have found it ever but for the steadfastness of that gnome Voronwe. Now the Gondothlim made their abode thus secret out of dread of Melko. Yet even so no few of the braver Noldali would slip down the river Sirion from those mountains. And if many perished so by Melko's evil, many finding this magic passage came at last to the city of stone, and swelled its people. Greatly did Tuor and Voronwë rejoice to find this gate. Yet entering, they found there a way dark, rough-going, and circuitous, and long time they travelled faltering within its tunnels. It was full of fearsome echoes, and there a countless stepping of feet would come behind them, so that Voronwë became adread, and said, "It is Melko's goblins, the orcs of the hills." Then would they run, falling over stones in the blackness, till they perceived it was but the deceit of the place. Thus did they come, after it seemed a measureless time of fearful groping, to a place where a far light glimmered, and making for this gleam they came to a gate like that by which they had entered, but in no way overgrown. Then they passed into the sunlight, and could for a while see naught, but instantly a great gong sounded, and there was a clash of armour, and behold, they were surrounded by warriors in steel. Then they looked up and could see, and lo, they were at the foot of steep hills, and these hills made a great circle wherein lay a wide plain, and set therein, not rightly at the midmost, but rather nearer to that place where they stood, was a great hill with a level top, and upon that summit rose a city in the new light of the morning. Then Voronwë spoke to the guard of the Gondothlim, and his speech they comprehended, for it was the sweet tongue of the gnomes. Then spoke Tuor also, and questioned where they might be, and who might be the folk in arms who stood about, for he was in amaze, and wondered much at the goodly fashion of their weapons. Then it was said to him by one of that company, "We are the guardians of the issue of the way of escape. Rejoice that ye have found it, for behold before you the city of seven names, where all who war with Melko may find hope." Then said Tuor, "What be those names?" And the chief of the guard made answer, "It is said and it is sung, Gondobar am I called, and Gondothlimbar, city of stone and city of the dwellers in stone. Gondolin, the stone of song, and Gwaristrin am I named, the tower of guard. Gar Thurion, or the secret place, for I am hidden from the eyes of Melko. But they who love me most greatly call me Loth, for like a flower am I, even Lothengriol, the flower that blooms on the plain." "Yet," said he, "in our daily speech we speak and we name it mostly Gondolin." Then said Voronwë, "Bring us thither, for we fain would enter." And Tuor said that his heart desired much to tread the ways of that fair city. Then said the chief of the guard that they themselves must abide here, for there were yet many days of their moon of watch to pass, but that Voronwë and Tuor might pass on to Gondolin, and moreover that they would need thereto no guide, for, lo, it stands fair to see and very clear, and its towers prick the heavens above the hill of watch in the midmost plain. Then Tuor and his companion fared over the plain that was of a marvellous level, broken but here and there by boulders round and smooth which lay amid a sward, and by pools in rocky beds. Many fair pathways lay across that plain, and they came after a day's light march to the foot of the hill of watch, which is in the tongue of the Noldali Amon Gwareth. Then did they begin to ascend the winding stairways which climbed up to the city gate, nor might any one reach that city save on foot, and espied from the walls. As the westward gate was golden in the last sunlight, did they come to the long stairs' head, and many eyes gazed upon them from the battlements and towers. But Tuor looked upon the walls of stone, and the uplifted towers, upon the glistering pinnacles of the town, and he looked upon the stairs of stone and marble, bordered by slender balustrades and cooled by the leap of thread-like waterfalls seeking the plain from the fountains of Amon Gwareth. And he fared as one in some dream of the gods. for he deemed not such things were seen by men in the visions of their sleep. So great was his amaze at the glory of Gondolin. Even so came they to the gates, Tuor in wonder, and Voronwë in great joy that daring much he had both brought Tuor hither in the will of Ulmo, and had himself thrown off the yoke of Melko for ever. Though he hated him no wise less, no longer did he dread that evil one with a binding terror. And of a sooth that spell which Melko held over the Noldali was one of bottomless dread, so that he seemed ever nigh them, even were they far from the hells of iron. And their hearts quaked, and they fled not even when they could. And to this Melko trusted often. Now is there a sally from the gates of Gondolin, and a throng comes about these twain in wonder, rejoicing that yet another of the Noldali has fled hither from Melko, and marvelling at the stature and the great limbs of Tuor, his heavy spear barbed with fishbone and his great harp. Rugged was his aspect, and his locks were unkempt, and he was clad in the skins of bears. It is written that in those days the fathers of the fathers of men were of less stature than men now are, and the children of Elfiness of greater growth. Yet was Tuor taller than any that stood there. Indeed the Gondothlim were not bent of back as some of their unhappy kin became, labouring without rest at delving and hammering for Melko, but small were they, and slender, and very lithe. They were swift of foot and surpassing fair, sweet and sad were their mouths, and their eyes had ever a joy within quivering to tears. For in those times the gnomes were exiles at heart, haunted with a desire for their ancient homes that faded not. But fate and unconquerable eagerness after knowledge had driven them into far places, and now were they hemmed by Melko, and must make their abiding as fair as they might by labour and by love. How it came ever that among men the Noldali have been confused with the orcs who are Melko's goblins, I know not, unless it be that certain of the Noldali were twisted to the evil of Melko and mingled among these orcs. For all that race were bred by Melko of the subterranean heats and slime. Their hearts were of granite and their bodies deformed, foul their faces which smiled not, but their laugh that of the clash of metal. And to nothing were they more fain than to aid in the basest of the purposes of Melko. The greatest hatred was between them and the Noldali, who named them Glamhoth, or Folk of Dreadful Hate. Behold, the armed guardians of the gate pressed back the thronging folk that gathered about the wanderers, and one among them spoke, saying, "This is a city of watch and ward, Gondolin on Amon Gwareth, where all may be free who are of true heart, but none may be free to enter unknown. Tell me then your names." But Voronwë named himself Bronwëg of the Gnomes, come hither by the will of Ulmo as guide to this son of men. And Tuor said, "I am Tuor, son of Peleg, son of Indor, of the House of the Swan, of the sons of the men of the north who live far hence. And I fare hither by the will of Ulmo of the outer oceans." Then all who listened grew silent, and his deep and rolling voice held them in amaze, for their own voices were fair as the plash of fountains. Then a saying arose among them, "Lead him before the king." Then did the throng return within the gates and the wanderers with them, and Tuor saw they were of iron and of great height and strength. Now the streets of Gondolin were paved with stone and wide, curbed with marble, and fair houses and courts amid gardens of bright flowers were set about the ways, and many towers of great slenderness and beauty, builded of white marble and carved most marvellously, rose to the heaven. Squares there were, lit with fountains, and the home of birds that sang amid the branches of their aged trees. But of all these, the greatest was that place where stood the king's palace, and the tower thereof was the loftiest in the city. And the fountains that played before the doors shot 20 fathoms and 7 in the air, and fell in a singing rain of crystal. Therein did the sun glitter splendidly by day, and the moon most magically shimmered by night. The birds that dwelt there were of the whiteness of snow, and their voices sweeter than a lullaby of music. On either side of the doors of the palace were two trees, one that bore blossom of gold and the other of silver. Nor did they ever fade, for they were shoots of old from the glorious trees of Valinor that lit those places before Melko and Gloomweaver withered them. And those trees the Gondothlim named Glingol and Bansil. Then Turgon, king of Gondolin, robed in white with a belt of gold, and a coronet of garnets was upon his head, stood before his doors and spoke from the head of the white stairs that led thereto. "Welcome, O man of the land of shadows! Lo, thy coming was set in our books of wisdom, and it has been written that there would come to pass many great things in the homes of the Gondothlim, whenso thou faredst hither." Then spoke Tuor, and Ulmo set power in his heart, and majesty in his voice. "Behold, O father of the city of stone, I am bidden by him who maketh deep music in the abyss, and who knoweth the mind of elves and men, to say unto thee that the days of release draw nigh. There have come to the ears of Ulmo whispers of your dwelling and your hill of vigilance against the evil of Melko, and he is glad. But his heart is wroth, and the hearts of the Valar are angered who sit in the mountains of Valinor and look upon the world from the peak of Taniquetil, seeing the sorrow of the thraldom of the Noldoli and the wanderings of men. For Melko ringeth them in the land of shadows beyond the hills of iron. Therefore have I been brought by a secret way to bid you number your hosts and prepare for battle, for the time is ripe." Then spoke Turgon, "That will I not do, though it be the words of Ulmo and all the Valar. I will not adventure this my people against the terror of the orcs, nor imperil my city against the fire of Melko." Then spoke Tuor, "Nay, if thou dost not now dare greatly, then will the orcs dwell forever, and possess in the end most of the mountains of the earth, and cease not to trouble both elves and men, even though by other means the Valar contrive hereafter to release the Noldoli. But if thou trust now to the Valar, though terrible the encounter, then shall the orcs fall, and Melko's power be minished to a little thing." But Turgon said that he was king of Gondolin, and no will should force him against his counsel to imperil the dear labour of long ages gone. But Tuor said, for thus was he bidden by Ulmo, who had feared the reluctance of Turgon, "Then am I bidden to say that men of the Gondothlim repair swiftly and secretly down the river Sirion to the sea, and there build them boats, and go seek back to Valinor. Lo, the paths thereto are forgotten, and the highways faded from the world, and the seas and mountains are about it. Yet still dwell there the elves on the hill of Kor, and the gods sit in Valinor, though their mirth is minished for sorrow and fear of Melko. And they hide their land and weave about it inaccessible magic that no evil come to its shores. Yet still might thy messengers win there, and turn their hearts that they rise in wrath and smite Melko, and destroy the hells of iron that he has wrought beneath the mountains of darkness." Then said Turgon, "Every year at the lifting of winter have messengers repaired swiftly and by stealth down the river that is called Sirion to the coasts of the great sea. And there builded them boats whereto have swans and gulls been harnessed, or the strong wings of the wind. And these have sought back beyond the moon and sun to Valinor. But the paths thereto are forgotten, and the highways faded from the world. And the seas and mountains are about it, and they that sit within in mirth reck little of the dread of Melko or the sorrow of the world, but hide their land and weave about it inaccessible magic, that no tidings of evil come ever to their ears. Nay, enough of my people have for years untold gone out to the wide waters never to return, but have perished in the deep places, or wander now lost in the shadows that have no paths. and at the coming of next year no more shall fare to the sea. But rather will we trust to ourselves and our city for the warding off of Melko, and thereto have the Valar been of scant help aforetime." Then Tuor's heart was heavy, and Voronwë wept. And Tuor sat by the great fountain of the king, and its splashing recalled the music of the waves, and his soul was troubled by the conches of Ulmo, and he would return down the waters of Sirion to the sea. But Turgon, who knew that Tuor, mortal as he was, had the favour of the Valar, marking his stout glance and the power of his voice, sent to him and bade him dwell in Gondolin, and be in his favour, and abide even in the royal halls if he would. Then Tuor, for he was weary, and that place was fair, said yea. And hence cometh the abiding of Tuor in Gondolin. Of all Tuor's deeds among the Gondothlim, the tales tell not. But it is said that many a time would he have stolen thence, growing weary of the concourses of folk, and thinking of empty forest and fell, or hearing afar the sea music of Ulmo, had not his heart been filled with love for a woman of the Gondothlim, and she was a daughter of the king. Now Tuor learnt many things in those realms taught by Voronwë, whom he loved, and who loved him exceeding greatly in return, or else was he instructed by the skilled men of the city and the wise men of the king. Wherefore he became a man far mightier than aforetime, and wisdom was in his counsel. And many things became clear to him that were unclear before, and many things known that are still unknown to mortal men. There he heard concerning that city of Gondolin, and how unstaying labour through ages of years had not sufficed to its building and adornment, whereat folk travailed yet. Of the delving of that hidden tunnel he heard, which the folk named the Way of Escape, and how there had been divided counsels in that matter, yet pity for the enthralled Noldali had prevailed in the end to its making. Of the guard without ceasing he was told, that was held there in arms, and likewise at certain low places in the encircling mountains, and how watchers dwelt ever vigilant on the highest peaks of that range, beside builded beacons ready for the fire. For never did that folk cease to look for an onslaught of the orcs, did their stronghold become known. Now, however, was the guard of the hills maintained rather by custom than necessity. For the Gondothlim had long ago, with unimagined toil, levelled and cleared and delved all that plain about Amon Gwareth, so that scarce gnome or bird or beast or snake could approach, but was espied from many leagues off. For among the Gondothlim were many whose eyes were keener than the very hawks of Manwë Sulimo, lord of gods and elves, who dwells upon Tanikwatil. And for this reason did they call that vale Tumladen, or the Valley of Smoothness. Now this great work was finished to their mind, and folk were the busier about the quarrying of metals, and the forging of all manner of swords and axes, spears and bills, and the fashioning of coats of mail, beanies and hauberks, greaves and vambraces, helms and shields. Now it was said to Tuor that already the whole folk of Gondolin, shooting with bows without stay, day or night, might not expend their hoarded arrows in many years, and that yearly their fear of the orcs grew the less for this. There learnt Tuor of building with stone, of masonry and the hewing of rock and marble. Crafts of weaving and spinning, broidure and painting did he fathom, and cunning in metals. Musics most delicate he there heard, and in these were they who dwelt in the southern city the most deeply skilled, for there played a profusion of murmuring founts and springs. Many of these subtleties Tuor mastered and learned to entwine with his songs, to the wonder and heart's joy of all who heard. Strange stories of the sun and moon and stars, of the manner of the earth and its elements, and of the depths of heaven were told to him. And the secret characters of the elves he learnt, and their speeches and old tongues, and heard tell of Ilúvatar, the Lord for always, who dwelleth beyond the world, of the great music of the Ainur about Ilúvatar's feet in the uttermost deeps of time, whence came the making of the world and the manner of it, and all therein, and their governance. Now for his skill and his great mastery over all lore and craft whatsoever, and his great courage of heart and body, did Tuor become a comfort and stay to the king who had no son, and he was beloved by the folk of Gondolin. Upon a time the king caused his most cunning artificers to fashion a suit of armour for Tuor as a great gift, and it was made of gnome steel overlaid with silver. But his helm was adorned with a device of metals and jewels, like to two swan wings, one on either side, and a swan's wing was wrought on his shield. But he carried an axe rather than a sword, and this in the speech of the Gondothlim he named Dramborleg, for its buffet stunned and its edge clove all armour. A house was built for him upon the southern walls, for he loved the free airs and liked not the close neighbourhood of other dwellings. There it was his delight often to stand on the battlements at dawn, and folk rejoiced to see the new light catch the wings of his helm, and many murmured and would fain have backed him into battle with the orcs, seeing that the speeches of those two, Tuor and Turgon, before the palace were known to many. But the matter went not further for reverence of Turgon, and because at this time in Tuor's heart the thought of the words of Ulmo seemed to have grown dim and far off. Now came days when Tuor had dwelt among the Gondothlim many years. Long had he known and cherished a love for the king's daughter, and now was his heart full of that love. Great love, too, had Idril for Tuor, and the strands of her fate were woven with his even from that day when first she gazed upon him from a high window as he stood a way-worn suppliant before the palace of the king. Little cause had Turgon to withstand their love, for he saw in Tuor a kinsman of comfort and great hope. Thus was first wed a child of men with a daughter of Elfiness, nor was Tuor the last. Less bliss have many had than they, and their sorrow in the end was great. Yet great was the mirth of those days when Idril and Tuor were wed before the folk in Gar Ainion, the place of the gods, nigh to the king's halls. A day of merriment was that wedding to the city of Gondolin, and of the greatest happiness to Tuor and Idril. Thereafter dwelt they in joy in that house upon the walls that looked out south over Tumladen, and this was good to the hearts of all in the city, save Meglin alone. Now that gnome was come of an ancient house, though now were its numbers less than others. But he himself was nephew to the king by his mother, the king's sister Isfin, and that tale may not here be told. Now the sign of Meglin was a sable mole, and he was great among quarrymen and a chief of the delvers after ore, and many of these belonged to his house. Less fair was he than most of this goodly folk, swart and of none too kindly mood, so that he won small love, and whispers there were that he had orc's blood in his veins, but I know not how this could be true. Now he had bid often with the king for the hand of Idril, yet Turgon, finding her very loath, had as often said nay. For him seemed Meglin's suit was caused as much by the desire of standing in high power beside the royal throne, as by love of that fair maid. Fair indeed was she, and brave thereto, and the people called her Idril of the Silver Feet, in that she went ever barefoot and bareheaded, king's daughter as she was, save only at pomps of the Ainur. And Meglin gnawed his anger, seeing Tuor thrust him out. In these days came to pass the fulfilment of the time of the desire of the Valar and the hope of the Eldalie. For in great love Idril bore to Tuor a son, and he was called Eärendil. Now thereto there are many interpretations both among elves and men, but belike it was a name wrought of some secret tongue among the Gondothlim, and that has perished with them from the dwellings of the earth. Now this babe was of greatest beauty. his skin of a shining white, and his eyes of a blue surpassing that of the sky in southern lands, bluer than the sapphires of the raiment of Manwë. And the envy of Meglin was deep at his birth, but the joy of Turgon and all the people very great indeed. Behold, now many years have gone since Tuor was lost amid the foothills and deserted by those Noldali. Yet many years too have gone since to Melko's ears came first those strange tidings, faint were they and various in form, of a man wandering amid the dales of the waters of Sirion. Now Melko was not much afraid of the race of men in those days of his great power, and for this reason did Ulmo work through one of this kindred for the better deceiving of Melko, seeing that no Valar and scarce any of the Eldar or Noldali might stir unmarked of his vigilance. Yet nonetheless foreboding smote that ill heart at the tidings, and he got together a mighty army of spies. Sons of the Orcs were there, with eyes of yellow and green like cats, that could pierce all glooms and see through mist or fog or night. Snakes that could go everywhither, and search all crannies or the deepest pits or the highest peaks, listen to every whisper that ran in the grass or echoed in the hills. Wolves there were, and ravening dogs, and great weasels full of the thirst of blood, whose nostrils could take scent moons old through running water, or whose eyes find among shingle footsteps that had passed a lifetime since. Owls came, and falcons, whose keen glances might descry by day or night the fluttering of small birds in all the woods of the world, and the movement of every mouse or vole or rat that crept or dwelt throughout the earth. All these he summoned to his hall of iron, and they came in multitudes. Thence he sent them over the earth to seek this man who had escaped from the land of shadows, but yet far more curiously and more intently to search out the dwelling of the Noldali that had escaped his thraldom. For these his heart burnt to destroy or to enslave. Now while Tuor dwelt in happiness and in great increase of knowledge and might in Gondolin, these creatures through the years, untiring, nosed among the stones and rocks, hunted the forests and the heaths, espied the airs and lofty places, tracked all the paths about the dales and plains, and neither let nor stayed. From this hunt they brought a wealth of tidings to Melko. Indeed, among many hidden things that they dragged to light, they discovered that way of escape whereby Tuor and Varonwë entered aforetime. Nor had they done so save by constraining some of the less stout of the Noldali with dire threats of torment to join in that great ransacking. For because of the magic about that gate, no folk of Melko unaided by the gnomes could come to it. Yet now they had pried of late far into its tunnels, and captured within many of the Noldali creeping there to flee from thraldom. They had scaled to the encircling hills at certain places, and gazed upon the beauty of the city of Gondolin and the strength of Amon Gwaith from afar. But into the plain they could not win, for the vigilance of its guardians and the difficulty of those mountains. Indeed, the Gondothlim were mighty archers, and bows they made of a marvel of power. Therewith they might shoot an arrow into heaven 7 times as far as could the best bowman among men shoot at a mark upon the ground. And they would have suffered no falcon to hover long over their plain, or snake to crawl therein. For they liked not creatures of blood, broodlings of Melko. Now in those days was Eärendil 1 year old when these ill tidings came to that city, of the spies of Melko, and how they encompassed the vale of Tumladen around. Then Turgon's heart was saddened, remembering the words of Tuor in past years before the palace doors, and he caused the watch and ward to be thrice strengthened at all points, and engines of war to be devised by his artificers and set upon the hill. Poisonous fires and hot liquids, arrows and great rocks was he prepared to shoot down on any who would assail those gleaming walls, and then he abode as well content as might be. But Tuor's heart was heavier than the king's, for now the words of Ulmo came ever to his mind, and their purport and gravity he understood more deeply than of old. Nor did he find any great comfort in Idril, for her heart boded more darkly even than his own. Know then that Idril had a great power of piercing with her thought the darkness of the hearts of elves and men, and the glooms of the future thereto, further even than is the common power of the kindreds of the Eldalier. Therefore she spoke thus on a day to Tuor, "Know, my husband, that my heart misgives me for doubt of Meglin, and I fear that he will bring an ill on this fair realm, though by no means may I see how or when. Yet I dread lest all that he knows of our doings and preparations become in some manner known to the foe, so that he devise a new means of whelming us, against which we have thought of no defence. Lo, I dreamed on a night that Meglin builded a furnace, and coming at us unawares, flung therein Eärendil our babe, and would after thrust in thee and me, but that for sorrow at the death of our fair child I would not resist." And Tuor answered, "There is reason in thy fear, for neither is my heart good towards Meglin. Yet is he the nephew of the king and thine own cousin, nor is there charge against him, and I see naught to do but to abide and watch." But Idril said, "This is my rede thereto. Gather thou in deep secret those delvers and quarrymen who by careful trial are found to hold least love for Meglin by reason of the pride and arrogance of his dealings among them. From these thou must choose trusty men to keep watch upon Meglin, whenso he fares to the outer hills. Yet I counsel thee to set the greater part of those in whose secrecy thou canst confide at a hidden delving, and to devise with their aid, howsoever cautious and slow that labour be, a secret way from thy house here beneath the rocks of this hill unto the vale below. Now this way must not lead toward the way of escape, for my heart bids me trust it not, but even to that far distant pass, the cleft of the eagles in the southern mountains. And the further this delving reach thitherward beneath the plain, so much the better would I esteem it. Yet let all of this labour be kept dark, save from a few. Now there are none such delvers of earth and rock as the Noldali, and this Melko knows. But in those places is the earth of a great hardness, and Tuor said, The rocks of the hill of Amon-Gwareth are as iron, and only with much travail may they be cloven. Yet if this be done in secret, then must great time and patience be added. But the stone of the floor of the Vale of Tumladen is as forged steel, nor may it be hewn without the knowledge of the Gondothlim, save in moons and years." Idril said then, "Sooth this may be, but such is my rede, and there is yet time to spare." Then Tuor said that he might not see all its purport, but better is any plan than a lack of counsel, and I will do even as thou sayest. Now it so chanced that not long after, Meglin went to the hills for the getting of ore, and straying in the mountains alone, was taken by some of the orcs prowling there, and they would do him evil and terrible hurt, knowing him to be a man of the Gondothlim. This was, however, unknown of Tuor's watchers. But evil came into the heart of Meglin, and he said to his captors, "Know then that I am Meglin, son of Eol, who had to wife Isfin, sister of Turgon, king of the Gondothlim." But they said, "What is that to us?" And Meglin answered, "Much is that to you, for if you slay me, be it speedy or slow, ye will lose great tidings concerning the city of Gondolin that your master would rejoice to hear." Then the orcs stayed their hands, and said they would give him life if the matters he opened to them seemed to merit that. And Meglin told them of all the fashion of that plain and city, of its walls and their height and thickness, and the valour of its gates. Of the host of men-at-arms who now obeyed Turgon he spoke, and the countless hoard of weapons gathered for their equipment, of the engines of war and the venomous fires. Then the orcs were wroth, and having heard these matters were yet for slaying him there and then, as one who impudently enlarged the power of his miserable folk to the mockery of the great might and puissance of Melko. But Meglin, catching at a straw, said, "Think ye not that ye would rather pleasure your master, if ye bore to his feet so noble a captive, that he might hear my tidings of himself and judge of their verity?" Now this seemed good to the orcs, and they returned from the mountains about Gondolin to the hills of iron and the dark halls of Melko. Thither they hailed Meglin with them, and now was he in a sore dread. But when he knelt before the black throne of Melko in terror of the grimness of the shapes about him, of the wolves that sat beneath that chair and of the adders that twined about its legs, Melko bade him speak. Then told he those tidings, and Melko, hearkening, spoke very fair to him, that the insolence of his heart in great measure returned. Now the end of this was that Melko, aided by the cunning of Meglin, devised a plan for the overthrow of Gondolin. For this Meglin's reward was to be a great captaincy among the orcs. Yet Melko purposed not in his heart to fulfil such a promise. But Tuor and Eärendil should Melko burn, and Idril be given to Meglin's arms. And such promises was that evil one fain to redeem. Yet as meed of treachery did Melko threaten Meglin with the torment of the Balrogs. Now these were demons with whips of flame and claws of steel, by whom he tormented those of the Noldali who durst withstand him in anything, and the Eldar have called them Malkarauki. But the rede that Meglin gave to Melko was that not all the host of the orcs nor the Balrogs in their fierceness might by assault or siege hope ever to overthrow the walls and gates of Gondolin, even if they availed to win unto the plain without. Therefore he counselled Melko to devise out of his sorceries a succour for his warriors in their endeavour. From the greatness of his wealth of metals and his powers of fire, he bid him make beasts like snakes and dragons of irresistible might, that should overcreep the encircling hills, and lap that plain and its fair city in flame and death. Then Meglin was bidden fare home, lest at his absence men suspect somewhat. But Melko wove about him the spell of bottomless dread, and he had thereafter neither joy nor quiet in his heart. Nonetheless he wore a fair mask of good liking and gaiety, so that men said, "Meglin is softened," and he was held in less disfavour, yet Idril feared him the more. Now Meglin said, "I have laboured much, and am minded to rest, and to join in the dance and the song and the merrymakings of the folk." And he went no more quarrying stone or ore in the hills, yet in sooth he sought herein to drown his fear and disquiet. A dread possessed him that Melko was ever at hand, and this came of the spell. And he durst never again wander amid the mines, lest he again fall in with the orcs, and be bidden once more to the terrors of the halls of darkness. Now the years fare by, and egged by Idril, Tuor keepeth ever at his secret delving. But seeing that the leaguer of spies hath grown thinner, Turgon dwelleth more at ease and in less fear. Yet these years are filled by Melko in the utmost ferment of labour, and all the thrall-folk of the Noldali must dig unceasingly for metals, while Melko sitteth and deviseth fires and calleth flames and smokes to come from the lower heats. Nor doth he suffer any of the Noldali to stray ever a foot from their places of bondage. Then on a time Melko assembled all his most cunning smiths and sorcerers, and of iron and flame they wrought a host of monsters, such as have only at that time been seen, and shall not again be till the great end. Some were all of iron so cunningly linked that they might flow like slow rivers of metal, or coil themselves around and above all obstacles before them, and these were filled in their innermost depths with the grimmest of the orcs with scimitars and spears. Others of bronze and copper were given hearts and spirits of blazing fire, and they blasted all that stood before them with the terror of their snorting, or trampled whatso escaped the ardour of their breath. Yet others were creatures of pure flame that writhed like ropes of molten metal, and they brought to ruin whatever fabric they came nigh, and iron and stone melted before them and became as water. And upon them rode the Balrogs in hundreds. And these were the most dire of all those monsters which Melko devised against Gondolin. Now when the seventh summer had gone since the treason of Meglin, and Earendel was yet of very tender years, though a valorous child, Melko withdrew all his spies, for every path and corner of the mountains was now known to him. Yet the Gondothlim thought in their unwariness that Melko would no longer seek against them, perceiving their might and the impregnable strength of their dwelling. But Idril fell into a dark mood, and the light of her face was clouded, and many wondered thereat. Yet Turgon reduced the watch and ward to its ancient numbers, and to somewhat less. And as autumn came, and the gathering of fruits was over, folk turned with glad hearts to the feasts of winter. But Tuor stood upon the battlements, and gazed upon the encircling hills. Now behold, Idril stood beside him, and the wind was in her hair, and Tuor thought that she was exceeding beautiful, and stooped to kiss her. But her face was sad, and she said, "Now come the days when thou must make choice." And Tuor knew not what she said. Then drawing him within their halls, she said to him how her heart misgave her for fear concerning Earendel their son, and foreboding that some great evil was nigh, and that Melko would be at the bottom of it. Then Tuor would comfort her, but might not. And she questioned him concerning the secret delving, and he said how it now led a league into the plain, and at that was her heart somewhat lightened. But still she counselled that the delving be pressed on, and that henceforth should speed way more than secrecy, because now is the time very near. And another reed she gave him, and this he took also, that certain of the bravest and most true among the lords and warriors of the Gondothlim be chosen with care and told of that secret way and its issue. These she counselled him to make into a stout guard, and to give them his emblem to wear that they become his folk, and to do this under pretext of the right and dignity of a great lord, kinsman to the king. "Moreover," said she, "I will get my father's favour to that." In secret, too, she whispered to folk that if the city came to its last stand, or Turgon be slain, that they rally about Tuor and her son. And to this they laughed a yea, saying, however, that Gondolin would stand as long as Tiniquetil or the mountains of Valinor. Yet to Turgon she spoke not openly, nor suffered Tuor to do so, as he desired, despite their love and reverence for him, a great and a noble and a glorious king he was, seeing that he trusted in Meglin, and held with blind obstinacy his belief in the impregnable might of the city, and that Melko sought no more against it, perceiving no hope therein. Now in this he was ever strengthened by the cunning sayings of Meglin. "Behold, the guile of that gnome was very great, for he wrought much in the dark, so that folk said, 'He doth well to bear the sign of a sable mole.' And by reason of the folly of certain of the quarrymen, and yet more by reason of the loose words of certain among his kin to whom word was somewhat unwarily spoken by Tuor, he gathered a knowledge of the secret work, and laid against that a plan of his own." So winter deepened, and it was very cold for those regions, so that frost fared about the plain of Tumladen, and ice lay on its pools. Yet the fountains played ever on Aman Gwareth, and the two trees blossomed, and folk made merry, till the day of terror that was hidden in the heart of Melko. In these ways that bitter winter passed, and the snows lay deeper than ever before on the encircling hills. Yet in its time a spring of wondrous glory melted the skirts of those white mantles, and the valley drank the waters and burst into flowers. So came and passed with revelry of children the festival of Nost na Lothian, or the birth of flowers. And the hearts of the Gondothlim were uplifted for the good promise of the year. And now at length is that great feast Tarnin Auster, or the Gates of Summer, near at hand. For know that on a night it was their custom to begin a solemn ceremony at midnight, continuing it even till the dawn of Tarnin Auster broke. And no voice was uttered in the city from midnight till the break of day, but the dawn they hailed with ancient songs. For years uncounted had the coming of summer thus been greeted with music of choirs standing upon their gleaming eastern wall. And now comes even the night of vigil, and the city is filled with silver lamps, while in the groves upon the new-leaved trees lights of jewelled colours swing, and low musics go along the ways, but no voice sings until the dawn. The sun has sunk beyond the hills, and folk array them for the festival very gladly and eagerly, glancing in expectation to the east. Lo, even when she had gone and all was dark, a new light suddenly began, and a glow there was, but it was beyond the northward heights. And men marvelled, and there was a thronging of the walls and battlements. Then wonder grew to doubt as the light waxed and became yet redder, and doubt to dread, as men saw the snow upon the mountains dyed as it were with blood. And thus it was that the fire serpents of Melko came upon Gondolin. Then came over the plain riders who bore breathless tidings from those who kept vigil on the peaks. And they told of the fiery hosts and the shapes like dragons, and said, "Melko is upon us." Great was the fear and anguish within that beauteous city, and the streets and byways were filled with the weeping of women and the wailing of children, and the squares with the mustering of soldiers and the ring of arms. There were the gleaming banners of all the great houses and kindreds of the Gondothlim. Mighty was the array of the house of the king, and their colours were white and gold and red, and their emblems the moon and the sun and the scarlet heart. Now in the midmost of these stood Tuor above all heads, and his mail of silver gleamed, and about him was a press of the stoutest of the folk. Lo, all these wore wings as it were of swans or gulls upon their helms, and the emblem of the white wing was upon their shields. But the folk of Meglin were drawn up in the same place, and sable was their harness, and they bore no sign or emblem, but their round caps of steel were covered with moleskin, and they fought with axes two-headed like mattocks. There Meglin, prince of Gondobar, gathered many warriors of dark countenance and lowering gaze about him, and a ruddy glow shone upon their faces and gleamed about the polished surfaces of their accoutrement. Behold, all the hills to the north were ablaze, and it was as if rivers of fire ran down the slopes that led to the plain of Tumladen, and folk might already feel the heat thereof. And many other kindreds were there, the folk of the Swallow and the Heavenly Arch, and from these folk came the greatest number and the best of the bowmen, and they were arrayed upon the broad places of the walls. Now the folk of the Swallow bore a fan of feathers on their helms, and they were arrayed in white and dark blue, and in purple and black, and showed an arrowhead on their shields. Their lord was Duilin, swiftest of all men to run and leap, and surest of archers at a mark. But they of the Heavenly Arch, being a folk of uncounted wealth, were arrayed in a glory of colours, and their arms were set with jewels that flamed in the light now over the sky. Every shield of that battalion was of the blue of the heavens, and its boss a jewel built of 7 gems, rubies and amethysts and sapphires, emeralds, chrysoprase, topaz and amber. But an opal of great size was set in their helms. Egalmoth was their chieftain, and wore a blue mantle upon which the stars were broidered in crystal, and his sword was bent, now none else of the Noldali bore curved swords. Yet he trusted rather to the bow, and shot therewith further than any among that host. There too were the folk of the Pillar, and of the Tower of Snow, and both these kindreds were marshalled by Penlod, tallest of gnomes. There were those of the Tree, and they were a great house, and their raiment was green. They fought with iron-studded clubs or with slings, and their lord Galdor was held the most valiant of all the Gondothlim, save Turgon alone. There stood the house of the Golden Flower, who bore a rayed sun upon their shield, and their chief Glorfindel bore a mantle so broidered in threads of gold that it was diapered with celandine as a field in spring, and his arms were damascened with cunning gold. Then came there from the south of the city the people of the Fountain, and Ecthelion was their lord, and silver and diamonds were their delight, and swords very long and bright and pale did they wield, and they went into battle to the music of flutes. Behind them came the host of the Harp, and this was a battalion of brave warriors, but their leader Salgant was a craven, and he fawned upon Meglin. They were dight with tassels of silver and tassels of gold, and a harp of silver shone in their blazonry upon a field of black. But Salgant bore one of gold, and he alone rode into battle of all the sons of the Gondothlim, and he was heavy and squat. Now the last of the battalions was furnished by the folk of the Hammer of Wrath, and of these came many of the best smiths and craftsmen, and all that kindred reverenced Aule the smith more than all other Ainur. They fought with great maces like hammers, and their shields were heavy, for their arms were very strong. In older days they had been much recruited by Noldali, who escaped from the mines of Melko, and the hatred of this house for the works of that evil one and the Balrogs, his demons, was exceeding great. Now their leader was Rog, strongest of the gnomes, scarce second in valour to that Galdor of the Tree. The sign of this people was the stricken anvil, and a hammer that smiteth sparks about it was set on their shields, and red, gold, and black iron was their delight. Very numerous was that battalion, nor had any amongst them a faint heart, and they won the greatest glory of all those fair houses in that struggle against doom. Yet were they ill-fated, and none ever fared away from that field, but fell